So on behalf of the Chicago Anti-War Coalition, I want to welcome everyone here to the forum. We're going to be taking up NATO, which is an extension of U.S. aggression, and naturally, we're going to be discussing Venezuela and how the U.S. is criminally interfering in the internal affairs. As well, we're going to have a presentation on the lessons that we've learned from the 2012 demonstration against NATO here in Chicago. And of course, we're going to try to make connections between the U.S. attacks, U.S. government attacks abroad, as well as on the people here at home. As you probably know, NATO is having its 70th anniversary with a summit to be held in Washington, D.C. on April 4th, which, as you may know, is also the anniversary of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You can see the irony there, terrible irony. So it's the responsibility of all people of good conscience to actively oppose both the current U.S. crime against Venezuela and NATO, which is carrying out crimes under the U.S. direction all over the world. First, let me give you a brief word about the Chicago Anti-War Coalition, and then we'll hear from the speakers. The Chicago Anti-War Coalition was formed last spring in response to a call for April demonstrations that came from the United National Anti-War Coalition, also known as UNAC. This call for coordinated national actions last spring was part of a call to rebuild the anti-war movement in the U.S. CAWC has been continuing to work on that, to further unite anti-war forces in Chicago. We had some 30 organizations endorsing our anti-war rally and march last April 21st, with a turnout of about 300 people. The anti-war movement is working especially hard now to oppose U.S. attempts to overthrow the elected government of Venezuela. Longer range, we're all aiming to bring out people by the thousands, as we were able to do for the 2012 demonstration in Chicago against the NATO summit. Before we go on, I want to bring up a practical matter. As part of us working together, I want to make an appeal for donations to print statements such as we have on the table and to print leaflets for wide distribution in the city. It's an effort to influence public opinion. So we'll pass around a donation bucket. Our forum has been supported by the following organizations who helped get the word out: Veterans for Peace Chicago, Cook County Green Party, Chicago Cuba Coalition, Albany Park, North Park, Mayfort Fair, Neighbors for Peace and Justice, Chicago Alba Solidarity, and the March 19th Anti-War Coalition. So what we're going to do is to have 3 8-to-10-minute presentations opposing NATO and its summit, against the U.S. coup in Venezuela, and lessons from the opposition to NATO here in Chicago in 2012, as well as bringing out the links between U.S. wars abroad and war on the people here at home, and what we need to do. And then the plan is to move into a circle to have back and forth discussion for at least an hour on questions or thoughts you have. In other words, the plan is to have a collective discussion to help us move towards solutions to the problems of ruling class interference and war against other countries. So the overall challenge is how can we win over public opinion? How can we move as many people as possible away from the lies that paralyze us and toward taking up more and more actions to oppose the crimes of the U.S. government with the U.S. banks and corporations that are behind the government? How can we explain what's really going on and show, one, that we are living under a system that does not serve the interests of the vast majority, and two, a better world is possible where everyday people decide, what's best for the society as a whole. So first, I'd like to introduce Rick Rosoff, who has contributed a great deal to the anti-war movement over the years by researching the crimes of NATO. For years, he put out vital information about NATO and put it into our hands every week. Today, Rick is going to give us a brief history and analysis that should put us in a good position to join in the opposition against NATO at the national demonstrations planned for March 30th through April 4th in Washington, as well as here locally. Rick?
Thank you. I want to thank the Chicago Anti-War Coalition and all of you for showing up, but particularly Neil and Betty. I met Neil 18 years ago at the University of Illinois Circle campus on the occasion of two information officers from NATO. I don't know if any of you realize there's a NATO headquarters in the United States, is and has been since the early 2000s, and represent so-called information officers from the British Army and the British Air Force spoke at that time. As for the first time in the history of NATO, and I should mention the last time, so-called Article 5 of the NATO Charter, which is euphemistically described as a mutual defense clause, in essence as a joint military support provision, was invoked after the 9/11 attacks of the United States. And we were being told that this was a limited anti-terrorist operation that NATO was supporting. In fact, 18 years later, not only the longest war in the history of Afghanistan, the longest war in the history of the United States, NATO's first war outside of Europe, most definitely outside of its so-called area of responsibility, one which at peak strength, roughly 8 years ago, at the point at which the Obama administration turned almost all U.S. personnel in Afghanistan over to NATO's International Security Assistance Force, was 150,000 troops from over 50 countries. Anyone acquainted with history, there's never been a war that had 50 belligerents before, much less on one side, in one theater, in one country, under the command of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So we may not hear this in the daily news, but this is a scope of what has transpired since the 50th anniversary NATO summit in Washington, the kind of other bookend of this thing in 1999, which was conducted while NATO was waging its first ever full-flight war against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia at that time, 78-day air war. It's subsequently been, they've added on a six-month war against the nation of Libya in 2011. So they've waged war in three continents, none of them within the area of responsibility of NATO, none of them anywhere near the North Atlantic Ocean, of course. And this is, I think, you know, the basis of what we have to look at. We're looking at an unparalleled military bloc, the scope of which would have been undreamt of even at the end of the Cold War in 1991 with the disintegration of the Soviet Union and of the Warsaw Pact. So that's, I'm going to be a little bit information heavy at the beginning. But I'm going to ease off a bit, and I think we can discuss in depth some of the other things during the question and answer period. First of all, there's an old adage that says a fool can ask more questions in an hour than a wise person can answer in a lifetime, and I'm sure we've all had occasion to prove the truth of that adage, maybe on both ends. And I think that there's going to be enough pro-NATO propaganda coming out between now and April 4th that's going to make it very difficult for us to refute some of their claims, but I'm going to attempt to do it in a very brief manner. The founding document of NATO, this is April of 1949, you know, mentions all the right words, right? It talks about freedom, the quotes, freedom, common heritage of Europe and North America, civilization of North America, also mentioned democracy, individual liberty, and rule of law. If you go to the NATO website today, and I invite you to, you're going to see all kinds of nice things. They're going to talk about climate change, they're going to talk about women's rights, they're going to talk about whatever you're interested in. But let us keep in mind, this is not a peacekeeping organization. It's not a climate control organization, though they address any number of climate-related issues for which they could militarily intervene. We're talking about an aggressive, global military bloc, pure and simple. The United States, as you may know, with the National Defense Authorization Act, is going to spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $720 billion on the military. That's the highest since 2011. It represents, in real dollars, the highest since World War II, at a time where the U.S. cannot even claim to have a serious adversary that is posing a threat to it, or I would argue even a nation that could defend itself against us. We're spending money at almost World War II levels. Between the United States and its NATO allies, they spend well over $1 trillion a year on arms, as though the human race wouldn't have better purposes for that $1 trillion. Any other purpose would be better. The current president of the United States has additionally shaken down NATO for an additional $100 billion for contributions towards their war budget. So we're talking about something that at the end of the Cold War, let's say in 1991, when the Soviet Union disintegrated into its 15 respective federal republics, the so-called Warsaw Pact, about which I'll say something in a moment, dissolved itself formally. That is, the purpose for which the United States and its allies claim they created the North Atlantic Treaty Organization having disappeared, NATO at that time had 16 members. It now has 29 members and 41 partners in every inhabited continent in the world. Not many of us have been told that, and you won't be told that by NATO, but you're going to hear it here. That is to say, 36% of the members of the United Nations are either NATO partners or NATO members. This includes three nuclear powers and three permanent members of the UN Security Council, Britain, France, United States. As of last October, Colombia officially joined as a NATO partner under a program initiated during the Chicago the meet of NATO in 2012 in a partner, I think a very revealing title, by the way, Partners Across the Globe is the name of the newest NATO partnership. Colombia joined last October. That means that now with Australia being a member of that same program and members of NATO in North Africa, in Europe, in the Middle East, and Asia, that every inhabited continent now has members or partners of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. By the way, those other eight members, the ones that were initiated into Partners Across the Globe in 2012, were all in the Asia-Pacific region, which I think is very interesting given recent developments with Pakistan and India, and with North Korea. Those countries are Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, Mongolia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq are full-fledged NATO partners. The Afghan military has been trained under the Afghan Training Act. The Iraqi military has been trained by NATO under a training program Iraq, which is a NATO program. Let's go back to the genesis of NATO. I think we need to know what this thing is before we can understand how it's morphed into what it is. It was formed in 1949. At that time, it's less than 4 years after the end of World War II. Though it's not mentioned in the founding document, it is quite transparently obvious that the target of NATO was the then Soviet Union, as it is now Russia, post-Soviet Russia. We have to recall that after 4 years of fending off the largest invasion force in the history of the race, of the human race, and of military warfare, that is, you know, the Operation Barbarossa invasion by Nazi Germany and its allies, after 4 years where the Soviet army lost anywhere between 10 and 12 million troops, that is half of the total combat deaths in World War II, not just in Europe, throughout the world. That is, in Europe, in North Africa, in the Middle East, in the South Pacific, and in Asia, half of the total combat deaths were with the armed forces of the Soviet Union. In their depleted state, we are to believe, according to NATO's logic, that they presented a threat to 100 divisions of British and U.S. forces in Europe at that time, in Italy and Western Europe. 100 divisions, 6.5 million troops. The entire Soviet armed forces at that point was only 7 billion troops, 1.5 million of which were fighting Japan in Mongolia and Manchuria and the northern part of Korea. So this is the rationale for the creation of NATO. I think we can safely disregard what they were claiming at the time. The Soviets were too depleted, even assuming they had any desire to roll tanks across Central Europe to go to the English Channel or something, they didn't have the capacity of doing it. As has been proven by the fact that once the Soviet Union disappears, far from NATO retiring, they expand into a global military bloc. So I think we have to, first of all, disabuse ourselves of certain misconceptions about NATO. When they talk about their democratic credentials, when they talk about individual liberty and so forth, let us also remember that 7 of the 12 founding members of NATO in 1949 were and remain constitutional monarchies, that NATO's founding members and eventually including their current members include every single major European colonial power: Britain, France, Portugal, Spain, Holland, Denmark, Italy, Germany. They include every country that was involved in the Atlantic African slave trade. They include every country that divided up Africa before and after the Congress of Berlin. They include, and I think this is very revealing because we're going to get some defenses of NATO seemingly emanating from left-wing sources, and I want to put this one to rest real quickly. NATO includes every single member as full members. Every single member of the fascist axis in Europe, the only one excluded is Japan, which I just told you is a NATO partner. That means Germany, Italy, Slovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania, all the axis powers are full members of NATO, as are their allies, Portugal and Spain. The only one missing is Finland, which is, I would argue, a NATO member in everything but name, and has been serving under NATO command in Afghanistan, waging combat operations, along with its neighbor Sweden. Sweden, which had not been at war for 200 years, has been waging war in northern Afghanistan under NATO command. So we have to know who we're talking about here. When they try to brandish their democratic credentials, this is the former colonial elite. These are the former people who divided up the continent of Africa. These are the people who constituted the Axis powers in Europe and so forth. And this is their real legacy and heritage, though they're loath to tell you that. A couple of things. There's going to be discussion about Venezuela. I think somewhere in our discussions afterwards, we're inevitably going to talk about Iran, where there's a similar threat of military conflict in the Persian Gulf. And somebody may say, what is the possible connection between North Atlantic Treaty Organization and South America? What connection between North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Persian Gulf? There is one in both cases. In 2006, NATO now has four permanent military groups, one of which, the standing NATO Maritime Group 1, for the first time ever in 2006, came down the entire Atlantic seaboard of the United States and visited the Caribbean. NATO countries, four NATO countries, still have possessions in the Caribbean. Those countries, of course, are the United States, Britain, France, and the Netherlands. In 2001, then Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez warned about a NATO plan called Operation Balboa, which would have been, entailed a NATO-assisted attack on Venezuela from a Dutch, British, French, and American territories in the Caribbean. We have to remember only two or three countries removed from Venezuela is French Guiana, which is still French possession. They conduct missile tests from that country, amongst other things, so that NATO as a military collective has the ability to interfere and intervene in South and Central America and the Caribbean. The following year, after the NATO military group came into the Caribbean, the United States, after having retired the Fourth Fleet, which is assigned to Southern Command, which takes in Central America, Caribbean, South America, reactivated it in 2007. So we now have a naval group, a permanent naval presence in the Caribbean as a result of that. This is, of course, connected with our NATO allies, with which we work with closely. There are several other things I have to wrap up. But just want to let you know, in the interim, too, that NATO has been given rights to police the entire Mediterranean Sea under a program called Operation Active Endeavor, a similar phenomenon off the coast of Somalia and the Horn of Africa, in the Arabian Sea called Operation Ocean Shield. This is an unparalleled military block that needs to be dismantled. And I'm hoping activities between now and April 4th can help publicize the need to do so.
Thank you very much, Rick. I'd like to point out that the Chicago Anti-War Coalition has a detailed statement on the history and crimes of NATO that goes into its aggressive role, and also a briefer fact sheet, which can pick up those two things at the table. Our next topic is on the trickery and crimes that the U.S. is committing right now to overthrow the government of Venezuela and steal its oil. And as Rick said, notice that the U.S. is using other countries, such as NATO, mainly NATO countries, and this includes Colombia, which is a NATO partner and is very, very actively supporting and having military operations ready to be used against Venezuela. Stansfield Smith will be going into these crimes. For a long time, Stan has actively opposed U.S. interference in Venezuela, including the U.S. attempts at coups in Venezuela in 2002 and then after that. Stan has in the last weeks helped organize two Chicago protests and leafleting here in downtown Chicago. These demonstrations were scheduled during the evening rush hour and included distribution of hundreds of informational leaflets to passersby. Stan also posts material on Venezuela online and is a supporter of the Venezuelan-led organization, ALBA, which was initiated by Venezuela with Nicaragua, Cuba, and Caribbean countries to develop economic cooperation in Latin America independent of the U.S. banking system. Stan?
Thank you. I see a lot of you here. I've seen at the demonstrations that we've had in Chicago against U.S. intervention in Venezuela, so far, there have been three since January 23rd, when Pence told Guido that he was going to be the new president of Venezuela because the U.S. didn't like the elected president. We had one on the 28th of January, and then the beginning of February, and then on the 23rd of February, which is supposed to be the 30th. The day the U.S. was going to intervene to make sure that this Guido became president, but all this has completely flopped. I don't have much time, so I'll just go over some quick points. First, the Trump policy towards Venezuela is not really any different from Obama's or Bush's. I know some people try to say Trump's is worse, but it was Bush that actually overthrew Chavez, killing a lot of people in the process. And we should remember that even when the Democrats do good things, we hear about it, and when they do nasty stuff like the Republicans, it gets covered up in the kind of media we read. Like, for instance, Obama did go to Cuba and recognize relations with Cuba, and establish relations with Cuba. But we are not told that, or maybe you don't know, that the fines on companies that traded with Cuba went up dramatically under Obama, more than Bush, more than Trump. Into billions of dollars, companies were fined for dealing with Cuba, even after they reestablished relations. I don't know how many people know that here, but It just shows you that when Democrats do stuff like that, we're not really informed about it. Now there's sanctions on Venezuela that by the United States, while the U.S. imposes sanctions on Venezuela and denies them the ability to import food and medicine, then they say that we want to send food and medicine there because there's a humanitarian crisis that basically is U.S. caused. The U.S., most international trade is in the U.S. dollar. So Venezuela cannot use a U.S. dollar for trade. Most banks around the world are controlled by the U.S., so Venezuela cannot use these banks. Most corporations around the world are connected with U.S. corporations. And they're often told, like they are with Cuba, if you trade with Venezuela, you're not trading with the United States. So which market do you want to go into? And so that basically puts a lot of restrictions on Venezuela importing and trading with other countries. U.S. is, they've also, banks in Europe have frozen Venezuelan funds for, Venezuela was going to import some doses of insulin that government paid for by Citibank, and Citibank refused to allow it. They also were going to import 18 million CLAP food boxes into Venezuela, which is food that the government distributes basically almost for free, but very, very cheaply, to people who are the poor people in the country. And the U.S. blocked that from happening. So while they're blocking food from being imported to Venezuela, then they complain that people there are starving. Which, people there are not starving. People are starving, and there's a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. People are starving there all the time, caused by the U.S., basically, in Saudi Arabia. And people, there's a humanitarian crisis also in Gaza, caused by Israel and the United States. Those are two big humanitarian crises in the world. It's not in Venezuela. And to impose sanctions on Venezuela, the U.S. has to declare, which is what Obama did, that Venezuela was an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, which is like,
Jesus Christ.
You haven't noticed that they've been threatening you. I don't know if this was 5 years ago that they've been threatening our, but that's what they have to, that's what they say, and they have to, like, supposedly substantiate it. And there are all these people in Congress and in government and all the newspapers and the editorial pages and newspapers who could say, well, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense, but it's not any threat to the United States. Maybe global warming is a threat or something like that, but Venezuela, that's just ridiculous. But you don't hear any of these people trying to take the president, make him defend it, what he's trying to say there. He's also say that U.S. has tried multiple times to have coups in Venezuela. I wouldn't have time to really go into them, but it's like, but maybe every other year they've tried to have a coup in Venezuela. And they repeatedly have failed. And if they failed again this time. Now one thing people hear, and even like the progressive community, they'll say that, well, Maduro was not democratically elected in the election in 2018, and it was not a fair election and needs to be done over. And Venezuela has had 25 elections in 20 years. In the 2018 election, there were three candidates in the election, two opposition candidates and President Maduro, who won the election. And he got about the same percent of the vote that Obama did in 2008, more than what Obama got in 2012, and more than what Trump got in 2016, when the loser in the U.S. election became the president. For the two out of five times this century, the loser of the election became the president, and we're telling other countries they don't have democratic elections. Now, there were two other candidates in the election, Henry Falcon, who received 21% of the vote, and this Javier Bertucci, who received 11%. So when you hear it was only, he didn't allow anybody to run against him, that's just total baloney. Furthermore, it was Venezuela went to the European Union and asked them to send representatives to observe the election last year, and they refused to do it. Venezuela went to United Nations, to the Secretary General of the UN, to ask for representatives of the UN to go observe the elections, and they refused to do it. They were setting up a thing to say, well, see, these elections are not fair. But there was a this is called the Council for Electoral Experts of Latin America, which is made up of several, the former president of the Supreme Court of Ecuador, the former president of the Supreme Court of Colombia, the former president of the Supreme Court of Honduras, one member, the former member of the Supreme Court of El Salvador, the vice president of the Supreme Court of Ecuador, and some others. They were all went to Venezuela for the election last May, which if you know these countries, they're not exactly like lefty countries. And they all said that these elections were free and fair and there was no problem. People who wanted to vote got to vote and their votes were respected. So when people say he stole the election somehow, President Maduro, that's just, it's without any basis. Just as like it's without any basis to say there's a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. Now, they also said that Venezuela is refusing international aid. It is not refusing international aid. It's refusing what the U.S. is trying to do. It's not refusing aid from, it's got aid from India, Russia, Turkey, China, United Nations. And the U.S., initially they said that they were going to provide $20 million worth of aid. I don't know how much on these trucks there was. That's 60 tons of food. And the CLAP program, the food program that Venezuela imports food to provide to the poor people, they distribute 42,000 tons of food a month. And the U.S. was going to import 60 tons. So it's 42,000 tons a month compared to 60 tons that the U.S. was going to bring. Now, they also say that Maduro was a repressive dictator. If I was going to try to argue that somehow their government is repressive or he's a dictator, I really don't think I could do it. Some of the police and the military did kill people in protests in 2017. 30 maybe? 25 or 30? And there was like 35 members of the police and the military who were arrested for doing this. Now you might want to compare that to here. How often when police kill people in this country do you see them getting arrested? You don't see more police getting arrested than the ones that they kill. That's what happened in Venezuela. And a lot of them, they're in jail now for what they did. You also don't see leaders in Venezuela who organized coup attempts against Chavez and Maduro, like Henry Capriles and Leopoldo Lopez and also Guido. After they organized coups and they failed coups, they were walking around free. Eventually, two of them are in house arrest. Guido is now out of the country. Well, I don't know what other countries in the world you could have people organizing coups against the government, and the government says, well, okay, we'll give you house arrest for 10 years. Or this guy now is, he's in Colombia, Guido, the present one. So I could not say that, if anything, they're not repressive enough on this opposition because these people repeatedly try coups and they're free to do it. They should crack down on it more. Now, did I mention that there's going to be national demonstrations on March 16th and March 30th in Washington, D.C.? March 16th is just against U.S. intervention in Venezuela. Also, are there progressives in Congress that are, well, I shouldn't say progressive, because there are people who are not what we call progressive who speak out openly against U.S. intervention, like Ron Paul, who's ex-congressman. But the people that we think are progressive, some of them have spoken out against U.S. intervention in Venezuela, like Tulsi Gabbard and Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But you're not, they're not real, they repeat a lot of the propaganda that we hear here. That, you know, he's a dictator and he's no good and he oppresses his people, but we shouldn't overthrow him. So their positions are not very good. I think the stuff that I've read by Ron Paul is actually better.
It really is.
So finally, Charlie Hardy, who has spoken a lot about Venezuela, who was a priest there for 30-some years, and he's been on national TV there, and he's traveled around the United States a lot speaking about the U.S. interference in Venezuela and what he saw there. He will be here March 16th, 17th, 18th, in Chicago, in Evanston Public Library, and in Purdue, in Third Unitarian Church. And we're also organizing a national tour of Dan Kovalik. And he'll be here sometime later in the spring. And if you're really interested to get more involved in Venezuela work defending it against U.S. intervention, there are conference calls about every week, Thursday and Friday, about people organizing around the country.
Thanks, Dan. For our next presentation, we will focus on some lessons we learned from our opposition to NATO in Chicago in 2012. What these show is the links between U.S. aggression and attacks on people abroad and on people here at home, and what we in the peace and justice movement need to do. Neil, who was active in the planning for the No to G8 and NATO summit, and who has been active on many fronts of the peace and justice movement, will be the speaker. Neil?
Thank you. I just want to mention on the opposition to U.S. In Venezuela, if you're interested in the March 16th demonstration in Washington, there's a bus, a chartered bus, that'll be leaving for that demonstration. And if you're interested in that, just let us know. And we'll put you in contact with the organizers of the bus. I think it's $120 round trip, with scholarships available for those who can't afford it. So what happened during our opposition to the NATO summit in Chicago in 2012 is very helpful for understanding the situation we face today and what we in the war movement need to do. There were attacks by the government in 2012 on our right to protest, and that's been an example of what's been happening all over the country with attacks against African Americans and Latinos and Native Americans and immigrants and on the working class. There have been attacks on social services for the poor, for example, a general culture of having the rich grow richer at the expense of the rest of the population and having a war on them. So it's clear we need to take up the slogan that's taken up on the anti-war movement and taken up on the war at home as well. What do we do when we're under attack? You know the answer.
Stand up, fight back.
Stand up, fight back. So in our Chicago-based opposition in 2012 to the G8 and NATO summits, we had many planning meetings with discussion and debate about how to proceed and democratic votes. So this is a process that we need to involve ourselves in and work collectively, not so much individually, and see what we can do about uniting despite differences. That was very important in 2012. So our work to mobilize other people encouraged thousands of people to participate, some coming from distant locations. We had veterans of the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan lead the march. It was a 3-mile march down toward where the G8 NATO, down toward where the NATO was. The government decided to pull the G8 meeting out of Chicago. They were so worried about the protest They moved it to Camp David. The protest by the veterans was very moving as they expressed their opposition to the aggressive imperialist U.S. wars that they had been lured into. They threw away medals, any medals they had been awarded, and they threw them in the direction of the U.S.-led NATO summit meeting. Now, the local government here in Chicago threw many obstacles in our path of organizing, something much of the population has to face every day. Examples were that the government insisted that we could not exercise our right to assemble, and we could not exercise our right to march unless we had some special permits. And then they would not grant those permits, at least without big opposition and fighting from us. So we did learn the importance of persisting. And we were not and have not been stopped from organizing, even though police at the end of the protest in 2012 brutally hit many people with clubs as a form of collective punishment for assembling and protesting. We learned that during the NATO summit, the ruling class and both of its main political parties is determined and ruthless about supporting aggressive institutions such as NATO. In 2012, both Obama and the former Secretary of State Albright were active at the NATO summit in support, and the Democratic Party actively tried to suppress our opposition and to stop us from using our basic rights, such as getting close to the summit, which was held at McCormick Place. They worked to stop our protest when we were ready to stop. Now today, one of the main slogans of the national campaign to rebuild the anti-war movement is to oppose U.S. wars against the people at home and as well as abroad. And these protests illustrated that we can do it. We have potential power. The 2012 demonstration showed the potential power of the anti-war movement as one aspect of the peace and justice movement. Look at the fears that we threw into the ruling class in 2012, even though we weren't that big. Look at the steps that the ruling class took in the face of our opposition, aside from moving GA out of Chicago. The NATO summit was designated a national special security event by the Department of Homeland Security. Authority over law enforcement belonged to the Federal Secret Service. They mobilized over 3,000 Chicago police, including to the anti-NATO protests, including SWAT teams, bicycle and horse units, and they had a sound machine that could deafen protesters. They also mobilized hundreds of National Guard. They mobilized state police units. They mobilized units of police from Southern Illinois, from North Carolina, from Philadelphia, and Milwaukee. They decided to strictly enforce the time to end the protest that was stated in the permits. And they surrounded hundreds of protesters who did not leave the area at Michigan and Cermak very promptly when they were told to, and they beat them unmercifully with clubs after surrounding them and not letting them leave at that point. There were hundreds of arrests in addition to the brutalization of many protesters. Now, prior to the protest, the FBI employed informants who surveilled those in opposition. Undercover police agents were used to set up and entrap some of the protesters and charge them with planning terroristic attacks, even though it was the Chicago police undercover agents who made the plans for the attacks and manipulated the young people into seeing how much of those plans they would take up. And then the government tried to divert attention from the opposition to the U.S.-led NATO summit to a focus on alleged terrorists who were in Chicago. Rick was saying before our meeting today that a number of his friends were so frightened by the threat of terrorists that they wouldn't come downtown for the protests against NATO. It worked, the psychological operation. So this shows that our peace and justice movement really threatens the ruling class. And it should be encouragement to us to continue building up our organized opposition to U.S. wars, our opposition to police killings, our opposition to cuts and social programs, and all that kind of thing, including the opposing the aggressive institutions such as NATO. So I'll just end there because of the time situation. But I want to say that we find a number of youth and others who feel there's nothing we can do. We need to show them that there are things that we can do. They think the ruling class is too strong. But this example that I mentioned to you shows up that they're frightened, and we should take advantage of that. In the fight against global warming and climate change, as well as U.S. wars abroad, and the attacks of people here at home. We know this from history. You had the Civil War against, we know about the struggle for the 8-hour day, even though there's efforts now not to have an 8-hour day, but a 12-hour day. Or we know about the struggle for that one Social Security, unemployment insurance, Medicare, voting rights, black people, other civil rights such as the right to have housing in various neighborhoods. There are victories that the working class and others have fought and won, and we can do that too. We should learn from that. The people of Venezuela are being tested on developing an alternative to the old rule by a rich elite, and they're being tested in fighting against the U.S. that's doing the same thing there in trying to suppress any opposition to have things the way for the banks and corporations.